Welcome to In-Depth, an in-depth look at the interesting, educational, and timely topics affecting you right here in Marion County and beyond. The one to count on for today's local news coverage is KNIA KRLS. And now with today's In-Depth, here is Dr. Bob Leonard.
What did Iowa do during the Holocaust, and what can we learn from that terrible event about the current refugee crisis? Let's go in depth with Michael Lewick Trams, Executive Director of Trace's Center for History and Culture in Mason City. So, Michael, why are you speaking at Central College?
Today we actually have two topics that dovetail well with each other. The first topic is about how Iowans responded to Jews and others fleeing the Nazis who came to Scattergood Hostel, a Quaker former boarding school that had closed during the Depression and became a refugee center. And then the other topic we'll be talking about is the refugee crisis in Europe at the moment. Again, these two topics dovetail very well, so I'm talking about both today.
So how did Iowa respond?
Well, you know, it's really quite amazing. The Quakers brought 185 Jews, but also political figures, artists, intellectuals, and other dissidents from Nazi Europe or those who'd already succeeded in fleeing from the East Coast to Iowa. You have to think about this. There were no freeways. There were no jet engines. Travel was much slower then. It was much more cumbersome. And yet, Iowa Quaker farmers and college kids succeed in bringing these people of all places to Iowa. There was some resistance. I think we need to be really honest about it, to bringing Jews. Even the Quakers who worked with the National Quaker Office in Philadelphia were conflicted, according to the motto, well, help the Jews, but don't be seen in the public as coddling the Jews. So there was an ambivalence there. But indeed, they brought these almost 200 people and then helped them find new jobs, which meant new lives, in Peoria, Kansas City, and Duluth. So their whole objective was to bring these European refugees from the East Coast and sell them in the American heartland. And in great measures, they were successful.
Okay, so do you know how many about were resettled here?
Yeah. The whole idea was that the Quakers were trying to avoid an anti-immigrant, anti-refugee backlash. Some people in New York refer to the Upper West Side as the Fourth Reich because of all the German refugees running around. There were hundreds, perhaps thousands, of refugees coming every year to the United States during the middle of the Hitler period, and they were desperate for a place to find some refuge. A lot of them were lawyers, doctors, people with means. However, English was not yet the world language. It was still French. So the Quakers had the idea to avoid an anti-immigrant, anti-refugee backlash in New York, plus to help the people integrate faster, bring them to the American heartland. And then the Quakers had a recipe that most of the time it was two refugees to every staff member. So this 2-to-1 ratio was actually a quite high exposure to the language, to American customs. The Quakers organized classes of American history. They had field trips to the Iowa City Press Citizen to see how a paper was written and published in America. They went to the U of I, which then had a different name, I think. They went to the U of I concerts. They went to Wagner Opera. They went to the Atlanta Colonies once a year at Valentine's Day. So as best they could, these Quaker hosts were trying to fast-track these refugees on how to adapt to their new country.
Well, and how did it work out?
Mostly it worked well. Remember that when the hostel opened in spring of 1939, this really was still the end of the Depression. So the Quakers were quite correct that there'd be less competition for some jobs in the Midwest than in urban New York or Boston or Philadelphia. But in truth, after initial placements in places like one young man got a night clerk job at a hotel in Corning, Iowa. Others were sent to Duluth to organize to run the YMCA cafeteria there in Duluth. So these were not really the kind of dream jobs that these European writers and professionals and others really wanted. So ultimately, the majority of them drifted to New York or at least Chicago. A few ended up in California. The people integrated generally quite well and relatively quickly. And in broad strokes, it's a success story. What's not so inspiring is, at the end of 4 years, the Quakers finally didn't run in the black. They were running the hostel with black. They didn't run it in the red. They finally had black numbers. They had a surplus rather than a deficit. But they couldn't get enough refugees. The war in Europe was getting more and more intense. So as the last refugees sort of filed through the hostel system, they said, well, we've got the staff. We've got the bedding and the tableware and the furniture and everything. we could bring Japanese-American internees from the desert, from camps, where the local people wouldn't have it. So the local people tolerated bringing European Jews and these strange, there were a couple communists there, there were artists, intellectuals, but when they're supposed to bring Japanese-Americans, almost all of whom had been born here, out of detention camps in the desert, they said no. That's a really black eye in an otherwise beautiful story.
But that wasn't the Quakers' black eye.
It was Iowans' black eye. In general, we were quite hospitable to the refugees, but when it came time to bring Japanese Americans, no. Resounding no. They had, it's like a B-rate movie, they had very emotional meetings in the West Branch gym. FBI officials came out from Chicago and elsewhere to testify. They saw no problem bringing Japanese-American internees to Iowa, and yet in the end they didn't bring them scattered good. They did take Japanese-American internees to Des Moines. Some of the staff members actually moved to Des Moines. That was the genesis of what's still the Des Moines Valley Friends meeting, the Quaker meeting where I was in attendance yesterday, were these young staff members bringing Japanese Americans to Des Moines, which did work.
More in depth after this. I continued my conversation about the Holocaust and the current refugee crisis with Michael Lewick Trams, historian. Okay, so we were more comfortable bringing Germans of a different nationality than we were bringing Americans of Japanese descent.
You see where the trail's leading. So Whitey was okay, but no Asians. So even German Jews, at least they were Germans, they could come. But Japanese Americans who were American citizens, all the children were born here, they were citizens, no. And people argue, well, it was a time of war. Well, we were at war in Germany, too. And the German refugees had a closer relationship to Nazi Germany than the Japanese Americans had to the Japanese Empire. So, I mean, it was really a stretch. I know it's not the topic at hand, but we also had an exhibit at Trace's Center of History and Culture that we also sent in a bus around the state called Vanished, about the 15,000 German Americans who were interned. Even though the Japanese apparently have a bigger lobby and more money, there were 15,000 Germans who were interned, most of whom were immigrants in the 1920s, early 30s, where there was a case of some sailors who were in New York when Pearl Harbor was bombed. They were interned in Bismarck, North Dakota. So we never talk about the 15,000 German-American internees, but we should, because those people, like the Japanese, never had a charge. Oh, you're behind barbed wire because you did this, this, and this. They never had a lawyer. They never had a trial. And there they sat, cooking under the Texas sun in Camp Crystal City, Texas, where other there were some 60 camps for the Germans and Japanese, as some of them as late as September 1948.
What lessons can we learn from this past refugee crisis to today?
There are several. There were a few people who said, oh, well, these Jews, they really won't fit in Iowa, but they did fine. So you could insert, oh, those Muslims, they won't do well in Iowa. But we know that some of the former Yugoslavians who came to Des Moines in the 90s. Some of them are Muslim, and they seem to be doing fine. So that argument doesn't work very well. Another lesson we can learn from the scattergood prototype is ordinary people can do extraordinary things if they want to. These Quaker hosts, the ones locally on the ground, were farmers and small townspeople who didn't have a lot of money. It was the end of the Great Depression, and yet they saved 185 lives. You can argue that across from 6 million Jews who perished at Auschwitz and Treblinka and the other death camps, 185 isn't very many, but it's 185 more than the Baptists down the road were saving, or the Catholics over in Davenport, or fill in the blank, or even Jews themselves. These Quakers were saving more European Jews than the local Jews. There was a lot of ambivalence, by the way, from German-descended Jews toward the Eastern European Jews. Eastern European Jews were not as welcome, the Russians and Poles. There were problems. That's a longer historical discussion, but already in the 1880s, 90s, up in Minnesota, the Bavarian-born Rabbi Weizmann, if I remember his name correctly, he would meet the Russian Jews at the train station and give them money and say, get back to the train and go to North Dakota. And they said, okay, and they got on the train, and they actually formed the first kibbutzim. We're not in Israel, they were North Dakota.
More in depth after this. I continued my conversation about the Holocaust and the current refugee crisis with Michael Lewick Trams, historian. It's a whole different time.
Yes.
Today. There wasn't general access to the weapons that people are using in terrorist attacks.
The questions on target, the equation's, I think, a bit wrong. So we're not looking at, are these people wanting to find refuge today, are they terrorists? I've been working with refugees in Germany. I live part of the time in Dresden. I'll be going there next week. In fact, I'll be speaking a week already from now. But these people, the ones who walked from Turkey through the Balkans to Germany, you know, we saw pictures of people being pushed in their wheelchairs who had lost their legs in bombs. We saw women, children, old people, young people, men by themselves, whole families. And they walked. They walked across Europe in the summer heat and the dust and the rain and the mud. So if you're a terrorist, if you're an ISIS operative or Al-Qaeda or anybody else, although Al-Qaeda seems relatively inactive at the moment, but if you're a young Arab who wants to pull shenanigans in Europe, you're not going to walk to the Balkans. You're going to fly, probably first class, from Beirut to Frankfurt, Main. You're going to get out of the plane and go pull a vest somewhere. Of course, you couldn't bring it in your luggage. You'd have to get it on the ground. So these people who are fleeing, most of them are not terrorists. What I would say is I just had an interview. One of the reasons I'm late for this interview, I just had a Skype interview with a young Jordanian who's studying accounting at a university in Dresden, and he wants to become one of our interns for our program. We've had 4 Jordanian interns. 2 were Muslims, 2 were Christians, great young men. Well, obviously they speak fluent Arabic. And he said, you know, Michael, those of you who don't speak Arabic wouldn't know, but we know that a lot of these ISIS kids are from Manchester, from Minneapolis, from Marseille, from Munich. And these kids are really the disaffected, those who've not integrated. Many of them were born, like the shooter at Orlando, was born in New York. The boy this summer who was in Munich and shot all those kids at the McDonald's in the shopping center near Olympic Village was born in Munich. There is a problem. These young men from 20 to 30, mostly born in those countries where their parents fled to or went to in the 70s, 80s, 90s, they're not integrating. I think one of the dangers that we have, for example, now this trial's beginning in the Carolinas, this white boy who went in and killed all these black worshippers in that church, no one says, oh, he's a Christian terrorist. Or Timothy McPhee, who blew up the Oklahoma City federal building years ago, he was a fundamentalist Christian. No one says, oh, Christian terrorists. But the couple in San Bernardino, who happened to be Muslim, and they took fire on their colleagues and workmates, you know, we say, well, they're Muslim terrorists. I think we need to rethink this. Can religion really be the main identifier with these cases? Then we should start saying when these white boys between 20 and 30 are at a convenience store in Michigan popping off people coming out of the shop, Christian terrorist. I mean, it'd be as fair or unfair as lumping together all these others and saying, well, they're Muslim terrorist. It's not that simple. The boy in Orlando, he might have said Allah Akbar at the end to get a bigger billing in the media, but deeper research shows he wasn't motivated by religion. He probably had self-loathing, homoerotic feelings he couldn't cope with. We need to look at the nuances here and to say, oh, well, all these refugees coming are going to blow up bridges and go on killing sprees. White boys from Iowa go on killing sprees. We've seen that. So we need to be really careful here. This is a complicated topic.
Yeah, it's very complicated, but when one says they're doing it in the name of the religion and one doesn't that mean anything?
Well, again, the case of the boy in Orlando, I mean, he had taken his wife to that bar before. He'd been to that bar. He was on gay profile pages. It's so complicated. He knew how to work the media, and this is one of the dangers of the whole social media era. These young kids, they exploit social media, and he knows if he says Allah Akbar, well, then media, when he's dead, it's all going to say, oh, well, you know, I'm part of Al-Qaeda or whatever. It gets him a lot of a draw. If he's just a kid from Queens living in Orlando with some personal problem against gays, it's not nearly as sexy as saying, oh, well, this is a terrorist. So, you know, these kids know how to milk the situation. This man who drove the truck on the promenade in Nice last summer, killing 88 people, I think, his family was really surprised because he didn't even have a particularly religious background. And so, you know, who knows what's going on in this process? I mean, the real topic is, why do we have so many people in the world who are so disaffected, they're not feeling part of their wider cultures? I work in schools all the time. I can tell you we have a lot of Iowa kids who don't really feel like they're part of the culture. We know that the suicide rates in this country are skyrocketing among young men, white men, between 15 and 25. Why? No job prospects, no girls, I don't know, but what's happening to our young men? This is the real issue. We can address it with religion. If you look at all the ISIS pictures of these young men bailing through the desert over in Syria and northern Iraq, it's great. It's an adventure. Sexy. They wear these black hoods. They get to chop off people's heads and rape people. It's not the same, but it's similar. In the 1930s, a lot of young men from the United States, Ernest Hemingway was one of them, they went to Spain. It was romantic to put on a hat and carry a gun and for 6 months be a beret-wearing soldier in the foothills of Spain. There's something deeper here at work. It's not so simple as religion. And when we look at refugees, whether they're Jews from Nazi Germany, whether they're Muslims or Christians from Syria, these are people who are fleeing. So we've got to find a way to sort out, to have a big sieve, a big filter, and take out the few that are candidates for radicalism and for violence, and then take the majority and help them get a job, get a home. One of the best anecdotes against homegrown terrorism is to help people to integrate. Make them help them feel they have a vested interest in their communities. They belong there. They're respected. They feel well, like you and I do on the way to work or on the way to church or shopping. We feel safe. We like our neighbors. That's the goal with these people as well. They're the same as us. They want to be happy. Their kids are secure. They have health care. And they want, you know, a nice home when they go home at the end of the work shift.
Thanks to Michael Lewick-Trams for contributing to the program. For KNIA KRLS News, this is Dr. Bob Leonard bringing you today's news and information in depth from our little corner of the universe.
In Depth is available for podcast in the radio audio media player on KNIAKRLS.com. You'll find additional information, pictures, and more, or subscribe to the In Depth podcast and never miss an episode. If you have local topics you'd like to hear on In Depth, send an email to Bob Leonard at KNIAKRLS.com. The one to count on for today's news and local information is KNIAKRLS and KNIAKRLS.com.